Today, copper sits around half of our estimated net asset value. That's been very deliberate. We see the fundamental outlook for copper is very strong, and I'll spend a second here telling you our view and the view of many market commentators. In short, the copper story in some respect combines structural long-term demand growth with constrained long-term supply additions, right? The real challenge in copper in some respects is that copper mines are getting older, the mines are getting deeper, it costs more to produce the copper. The average grade of copper produced has declined substantially. And to give you an example, in the early 2000s, it was estimated the average copper mine had a grade of around 1% from all global production. Today, that's estimated around 0.6%, and that's expected to decline as you move forward in the next 20 years. So, in other words, all this means is that the cost of bringing new mines on scale is higher, the operating costs are higher, and combined with strong demand, many market commentators believe that this will increase the copper price necessary to incentivize supply additions. And as a royalty company, back to your original point, our exposure is to the revenue line. So what have we seen this year? Well, first of all, earlier this year in April, and from a strategic perspective, I mean, right? If you're a government and you're looking at the rare earth markets, the market fundamentally changed, I think, when the Chinese government, as a result of ongoing trade discussions, used the rare earths they produce as a geopolitical tool.
Mark Bishop Lafleche, Ecora Resources, how are you today, my friend?
Very well, Andy. Thanks for having me back.
Thanks for coming on. And to all my viewers and listeners, I'm a very happy and proud shareholder. I started buying in towards the end of August. Also, full disclosure, Mark and I met at the Rule Symposium in July. I made a list of 10 companies that I really liked and started deep dive in. Ecora Resources was near or at the top of that list. So, Mark, again, I want to reiterate what I liked about you so much, and what really got me initially interested is that you are a royalties company, which I love the model, but you're very different because of your exposure into many different commodities. You're just not a gold royalty or silver royalty, which I own those, full disclosure as well, but that you're very different. Specifically, also, I loved your exposure to copper. So let's talk first about why you have exposure to copper. Tell me about the market in copper, because I think that's a huge advantage for Ecora Resources. Talk to me about that, and then talk to me about the exposure that Ecora has.
Okay, well, why don't we just let's start with copper. We started positioning this portfolio to grow our copper exposure, really starting with the first transaction in 2019. And from then, taking our exposure materially close to zero. Today, copper sits around half of our estimated net asset value. That's been very deliberate. We see the fundamental outlook for copper as very strong. And I'll spend a second here telling you our view and the view of many market commentators. In short, the copper story in some respect combines structural long-term demand growth with constrained long-term supply additions, right? The real challenge in copper in some respects is that copper mines are getting older, the mines are getting deeper, it costs more to produce the copper. The average grade of copper produced has declined substantially. And to give you an example, in the early 2000s, it was estimated the average copper mine had a grade of around 1% from all global production. Today, that's estimated around 0.6%, and that's expected to decline as you move forward in the next 20 years. So, in other words, all this means is that the cost of bringing new mines on scale is higher, the operating costs are higher, and combined with strong demand, many market commentators believe that this will increase the copper price necessary to incentivize supply additions. And as a royalty company, back to your original point, our exposure is to the revenue line. As a royalty company, we don't have exposure directly to the operating costs of a copper mine or any of our royalties. We don't have exposure directly to the capital costs to build a mine, which have increased substantially over the last 10, 20, 30 years. Thus, we really benefit from those underlying factors just as copper prices increase in time, simply as a result of inflation, but also because of the longer-term demand-supply dynamics I just articulated.
Yeah. Okay. So I'm going to talk to all my viewers and listeners here. Mark is being very calculated and careful because he has to, because he's the CEO of a publicly traded company. And these are not Mark's words, these are mine. We have a shortage of copper here. And we're going into a shortage here. That's made the copper price spike, and there will be very volatile moving forward. But longer term, we got to short the earth has a shortage of copper here. Those are my thoughts. Now,
Well,
Mark, go
I
ahead.
would actually go further, and I would sort of agree with that. If you look at global inventory levels today, they're very, very tight on historical levels, right? That's the starting point. And you also have to combine that with one of the past decade, at least, let's just say, with very low investment, cyclically speaking and historically speaking, to identify the next wave of supply. So when you combine that with the environment as it stands today, in other words, you have low sensitivity to operating cost drivers. So in other words, oil prices today are quite low. That's very different to where we were at the time of the last copper cycle. Oil prices actually at the time were quite high, above $100 per barrel. So there was room for oil prices to come down. There was room for margins to expand on the operating side, right? Labor costs today are being pushed upwards as a function of inflation. So, tight supply, increasing operating costs, and if anything, the operating costs are likely to increase rather than decrease as a result of inflationary pressures, limited scope for new supply additions and strong demand. I mean, the picture is fundamentally the fundamental outlook, as I mentioned, to put it in other words, is really, really strong. And this is why, we deliberately positioned our portfolio to copper. There are, as you mentioned, many royalty companies who focus on precious metals. We sought out to build something different. We sought out to build a portfolio that was exposed to the longer term trends of energy demand growth. And whether that be EV demand, you believe in robotics, and by robotics, it could be just manufacturing. It can be humanoid type robotics. It can be delivery, sort of self-delivery vehicles, EV robotics in that sense. I mean, the list is long. But on top of that, you have the trends of GDP growth, AI,
AI.
urbanization. Some of the above, all of the above, we really positioned our portfolio to these structural multi-decade trends. And you find that in Ecora with our copper exposure that we'll talk about today, but also our cobalt, our uranium, our vanadium, our rare earths, our nickel exposures. So yeah, back to your question though. In short, the market today for copper is very, very tight. And part of that is, demand, of course, but also on the supply side. This year we've seen some sizable disruptions starting from a point where inventories, as you said, Andy, were quite tight. I have a few figures here that some of your viewers may find interesting.
Please.
The world's largest mine, Escondida, produces, call it, just over 120,000 ton, 1.2 million tons of copper last year. The second biggest mine, Grasberg in Indonesia, 800,000 tons, and that's now offline as a result of an industrial accident. The fifth or sixth biggest mine, Kamoa-Kakula, has had operational incidents. That's just over 400,000 tons metric. El Teniente, a mine in Chile, just under 400,000 tons, has had a medium-sized production impact this year. Cobre Panama, a mine by First Quantum, is effectively offline as a result of a dispute with the government. That's 400,000 tons.
Yep.
So effectively what you are today, what we see is a copper market that is estimated to be in a deficit right now as a result of these supply side issues. And you have an economy in growth that has been more resilient than many expected, right? Many expected copper demand this year to be really hit much harder than it has from tariffs. And to date, that hasn't quite materialized. So yeah, I think we're very, the supply side story, I think, is quite positive for the next 2, 3 years as a result of this disruption. And by the way, in my opinion, I think we're likely to see some level of disruption in this industry that's slightly above historical norms, just as a result of where the new mining operations are built and by a result of these the underground ore bodies inherently being more difficult to access as they get older. And whether that's to this, hopefully not to the scale that we've seen of late, which has been quite tragic as a result of, it's in some instances resulted in a loss of life, which is horrible. But beyond the sort of short-term impact, and as the operations will come back on stream, there's expected to be strong demand growth, right? And today it's estimated that one of the biggest demand growths for copper is no longer China, although that is a key part, that's expected to move towards grid investment, which is quite fundamental to any modern society. So yeah, we're very constructive on copper at Ecora, and we should be because we deliberately positioned our portfolio to copper. And it's nice to see what we've sort of expected to come for a long time now coming through.
Yeah, no, it's a good time to be a copper bull, but also it's a good time to be invested in copper. You just brought up a lot of different instances, and I want to put that to how that affects a royalty company, or if it affects a royalty company. You talked about cost, for example, the cost of energy impacting the margins, but also the list goes on that you didn't mention. There's permitting, if you would. To all my viewers and listeners, I've been invested in copper mines before, and it's actually to my detriment in many cases, just because of the time it takes to get a mine online. It takes years, if not decades, to get a new copper mine. You got to do the discovery. You got to do all the permitting. The list, there's jurisdiction risks, if you would. There's labor risks. How does Ecora handle that, really, in a royalty company? And I know the answer to this, but I want you to address it, because this is the beauty of a royalty company, in my opinion. But talk about that.
Yeah, the first way is you can look to buy royalties on producing mines, right? That's part of it. And that we've done that in part. Now we have two producing copper royalties today of size. We have some legacy exposures or some smaller exposures, but yeah, the two chunky ones are Mantos Blancos and the Mimbula copper stream that we acquired earlier this year, that I think actually we spoke about when I was last on your show. And beyond that, look for operations that sit really low on the cost curve, right? With strong management teams. As you're laughing because you knew I'd say that. But effectively, the operations or projects with the best economics are the ones that generally attract the most capital, and are the ones that generally, not always, but generally are the ones first off the ranks when markets turn or when capital is being allocated. So, as a royalty company, you want to be at the low end of the cost curve for two reasons. Number one, once your assets are in your royalties are over mines that are in production, you want them to stay in production. And the best way you can achieve that and the highest likelihood is that for these operations to generate really strong operating margins. So that's part one of the plan. And then the second step, royalties over, as I mentioned, low-cost operations with the most attractive economics. And these are generally the ones that, within very long permitting timeframes, tend to do the best. And within our portfolio, we have producing royalties in copper, royalties over projects that are already permitted, so sort of the next wave of growth in our income from copper. And then beyond that, longer dated is those development stage assets as well. So we have, at a core, a full wide pipeline of copper growth that carries us well into the next decade.
Yeah, so I want to talk about that, what you got coming on, what do you have online and coming on again. But I chuckled because a royalty company doesn't really have the negative exposure, if you would, of the risk of, and I'm going to really simplify this to all my viewers and listeners, you don't have the risk of higher energy prices. You don't really have the risk of getting permitted, there is some risk with stuff that's coming online, but you just don't have the overhead, if you would, in the capital expenditures that a specific mine or a specific mining company has. And so, and again, oversimplification, you have the royalty and you collect the check. That's the beauty of it, correct?
Yeah, I mean, look, the key is that the asset stays in production.
Right.
Because you're right, we don't have direct exposure, but if the operation is not generating positive cash flow, eventually operations will stop.
Right.
So we've also been very deliberate in that sense as well.
I want to get that. Go ahead, work that out. Go ahead.
We spoke about it last time we spoke, but about 80% of our portfolio is over mines in production or projects that are expected to produce at the lowest 50% of all producers in that respective commodity. And that's been very deliberate to ensure that exactly we're far less sensitive to the volatility of a profit margin of a miner if it's 45% or 46% or 36% or 62%. But provided the operation generates, provided we have the ability to have a royalty that'll benefit from general inflationary pressures, demand growth. 20 years ago, copper was what, plus or minus $1 per pound, right? Today, just under $5 per pound. And I don't know what it'll be 20 years from now, but if you're a royalty company, if your entitlement is 1%, you would have gone from, 1 cent to 5 cents per pound. And that's the beauty of this model, as you articulated it. We, of course, agree.
Yeah. So talk to me again. We discussed this, but let's t previously, but discuss a little bit more in depth here. What percentage of the Ecora portfolio has copper exposure? What do you have online? What percentage of that do you have online? And this is what's really key to me. What do you have coming online that is going to really further your growth of Ecora?
Yeah, so today our producing royalties are Mantos Blancos, and that royalty is on broker consensus is expected to generate just under $8 million this year, ramping up towards 9 or 10 as you move towards the end of the decade. That royalty has some great optionality and expansion potential that exists. We spoke about it when I was last on your show, so I won't go into the detail, but that's something we're very excited about, which is potential for a Mantos Blancos phase two expansion. We also have a stream over the producing Mimbula copper mine, and that royalty at full production capacity is expected to generate, when we bought it, around 10 million per year. Although that would probably be higher if you were to run spot copper. Well, it would definitely be higher if you were to run spot copper today. And that operation is in the midst of an expansion from producing around 14,000 tons of copper last year to total production of 56,000 tons of production. Next is a royalty over Capstone Santo Domingo project. This project is materially has the key permits to come into production. It's very low cost, long life type project in Chile. And we there have a royalty that, if you ran spot, is probably $35 to $40 million a year once in production. So that one's very material to us and one we're tracking carefully. Another source of copper exposure is at the West Musgrave project. This is a BHP project, copper nickel. It was, in its originally conception, really perceived as a copper project, which became a bit more of a nickel project when acquired by BHP as a source of feed for the downstream Nickel West operations. BHP has obviously put its nickel division on hold, and the West Musgrave project construction as well. And this now is, I suppose, an opportunity for this project to change ownership. BHP has announced publicly that they would consider selling this asset, and we shall see what happens. But in any event, there are not too many assets like West Musgrave, and by that I mean in Australia, fully permitted, expected to be very low cost, a couple of years from cash flow, and call it 25% built. So we'll have to see what happens and what BHP decides to do. That's a good quality asset, though, that we think in time will generate a lot of income for Ecora. As exactly when, though, is a big question mark there.
Yeah. So there's a couple of other questions I want to get to, but let me, I wasn't planning on asking you this, but I want to ask it anyways. How do you evaluate a project for Ecora to go into? And again, you are very, and I mean this with the highest amount of admiration, you're a very calculated person. And to all my viewers and listeners, you really want that in a CEO. So what's your evaluation process? Are there jurisdictions that are, and you don't have to name them, but are they off limits, or are there other jurisdictions that are more attractive, if you would? But yeah, what's your evaluation process really in all of this?
Yeah, so it's a lot of ground to cover, and I won't go into all areas, but just to give you a few, which are some of the big ones, but again, not exhaustive. I think first and foremost, it's just quality of the ore body, right? Because by virtue of quality of the ore body, from there you'll have your cost exposure, and you're generally low-cost operations with the highest quality ore bodies, you'll have the potential for life of mine expansion, which is always desirable when you buy a royalty. So in other words, you might think the mine has a plan of 20 years. It could potentially run for 20 beyond that with the right ore body. So that's definitely something we seek. It's not always achievable, but it's something we seek. We seek really strong management teams. We're a royalty company. We're not meant to run the operations, but effectively, we're backing management teams to either develop projects or run projects. And the management teams we choose to work with is something we think about very carefully. And today, we've been quite lucky to have the opportunity to partner with really solid management teams that we really regard and who that we hold in high regard and respect, that have proven track records. And then commodity selection. And commodity selection is in part driven off of entry points. I mean, we target a suite of critical minerals that don't trade at all times in the same direction. So in other words, commodity A might be up, commodity B might be down, cyclically speaking. And we have to, as a royalty company, try to buy entry points that provide at least some price upside through cycle rather than price downside. So to give you an example, right, we were very reluctant to buy lithium royalties. The lithium prices were $80,000 per ton hydroxide. Today, hydroxide prices are around $10,000 per ton. While we might not be able to price a really good quality lithium royalty at those levels on spot, it still offers a much more relatively attractive entry point where you have much more price upside than downside. And those are three of the big ones. There are more. You also mentioned jurisdiction. So at its simplest, what we're looking for are jurisdictions where there is a clear historical, well-established mining framework, right? Good mining jurisdictions. And you can find those, of course, in places like Canada. You can find them elsewhere as well. So our portfolio today, though, is primarily Australia, Canada, Brazil, Chile. We have some exposures small exposure in Zambia as a part of our portfolio. And this is to a tier one project that's expected to be amongst, towards the low end of global operating costs, which provides quite a lot of margin for just things to go wrong. In other words, if you're generating at made up numbers, 60% EBITDA margins, you have a lot of room for the unforeseen, right? And similarly, in the rare earths project where we have exposure in South Africa, this is expected to be amongst the highest rare earth projects outside of China. From a margin perspective, super resilient, very defensive. So the common theme across all this is just defensive exposures, good quality ore bodies, defensive exposures that in time, once they're in production, well, first that are likely to progress to production if they're not already, and then once they're in production, hopefully stay in production and in time, hopefully get even bigger and longer.
Yeah. So let me just talk to, I want to go to the other commodities exposures that you have, a few of them. But before I say that, I want to talk to my viewers and listeners just once again. This is really, and I mean with this, with the highest regard to royalty companies and specifically Ecora. This oftentimes, and do your own diligence. I'm not saying don't do your own diligence, but that being said, it's almost the lazy way for an investor, a great way, but a lazy way for an investor to get exposure to commodities, specifically with Ecora, copper, as well as different commodities that we're about to get into. And I say that, just listen to what Mark just said. Just replay this, just what he said. All of this due diligence, whether that's management, that's what I look at. It's probably my number one thing. My second would be jurisdictions and what assets that they have. But then he's also said something really key there, and it's I would say not really commodity timing, but commodity value. And that's really what you want to look at it as an investor. What value is it in the marketplace? And something key that you said is you didn't want to buy lithium when it was up so high, because again, that can be and often is quite risky. You want to buy, as the old saying goes, is you want to buy straw hats in the winter, and that's what you're looking at, if you would, so you get that upside when the cycle does come turn around again. So That's how I look at resource, co I mean, royalty companies, if you would. That being said, yeah, do your own due diligence on this. And that's why, but that is why I am an investor in Ecora. Mark, talk about some of the other commodities that you have exposure in. And when I met you, this also stood out to me, cobalt. Why cobalt? How much of it do you have? Tell me about all of that in the portfolio. And then let's talk about rare earths.
So cobalt is something that the market on cobalt has changed incredibly quickly in the last 9 months. When we first met in July, it was sort of on the up, but I think from where we sit to today, there's a huge amount of price momentum in the cobalt market, and I think we're incredibly well positioned to benefit on that front. So why don't we just start with the cobalt market and then jump into what it means for Ecora? In a nutshell, the cobalt market last year, total demand globally was around 200,000 tons. Of that, the majority of cobalt demand is into, and by way of order of demand, first into battery storage for EVs, next into portable electronics, so sort of cell phones, laptops, cameras, these types of things, and then into alloying. So in other words, using cobalt, mixing it with metal, and then using it in primary, a big chunk of that market is actually jet engine turbine blades. And across those three dimensions, if not more, cobalt as a metal provides thermal resistance, right? In a battery, it prevents thermal runaway, or in other words, a fire in a battery. And as an alloying agent, improves the metal's ability to operate at high temperatures. The government of DRC at the beginning of this year announced a cobalt export ban. This follows.
Gosh, I wasn't aware of that. Go ahead. Oh, gosh.
Yeah, so what you saw last year on the demand side, 14% demand growth. That sounds great, right? But on the supply side, there have been some real sizable additions in supply, primarily from one operator with two operations in the DRC that saw the cobalt market quite heavily oversupplied in last year and to some degree the year before. So the DRC government, with a dominant market share position, right, of somewhere around 65 to 70%, imposed an export ban. And the aim of the export ban was to allow some of these accumulated inventories that had been produced that were sitting sort of in the flow of the global economic supply chain. And the export ban allowed some time for this material to be consumed, right? In other words, no new material coming, but the material that had been accumulated working through the system. And recently, just around 2 weeks, slightly more than 2 weeks ago, the DRC announced that they were going to follow up with a quota system. So starting in October of this year, reallowing exports, but not huge volumes this year. And then next year, reallowing exports once again, with the total export quota set of just under half of total 2024 estimated market demand.
It's
Yeah.
scary,
So,
almost.
yes, I think what this positions us for is a much better market balance. The DRC government does not seem to be shooting for the highest possible cobalt price and keeping it there. I think what they're looking for is a much healthier market. They seem, based on public statements, to be targeting a level of supply that achieves roughly 1 month of inventory, which is generally healthier for the price. And fair play to them. These are their own minerals, and they should seek to ensure that the minerals are extracted at a price that generates the most value for their citizens, right? So where we sit today, we've seen cobalt prices move quite quickly. When we
Since
just around,
July,
yeah.
go
So
ahead.
when we in July, prices were around $18 per pound for the product we get, alloy grade cobalt, which is a bit higher than sort of the standard grade price that everyone talks about usually. And today, the alloy grade price is right around $21. So we've seen the price go this year from the start of the year, a very oversupplied market, around $14 per pound to today, around $21. And 21 is definitely better, but in the context of where cobalt has been historically, we've seen cobalt from the lows of around 14, and again, this is alloy grade product, to highs in the 40s. So 21, 22, that's really sort of a midpoint price, actually, when you think about where it's gone cyclically. Many research analysts have updated cobalt prices for a much tighter market dynamic. And Ecora is really well positioned to benefit from this by virtue of a producing cobalt stream we have. So we have an entitlement to a portion of the cobalt produced at Vale's Voisey's Bay mine in Canada. That operation being in Canada is obviously not directly impacted by any of the export quotas or bans that were implemented in the DRC. At $25 cobalt, the cobalt and full production from the mine, we expect around $25 million of EBITDA and around $20 cobalt. Again, and at life of mine average production profile for the operation, we expect around $20 million of EBITDA. So this mine now is finally the last phases of a ramp up profile, moving from an open pit to an underground. The operation is produced earlier this year, just under 94% of throughput, nameplate throughput capacity. And so next year, you'd expect that operation to be hitting sort of nameplate levels. So there's a lot to love about our positioning in terms of the volume growth, but also the price tailwind we see in cobalt as well. And I don't think it's yet reflected in our revenue and earnings forecasts by analysts who it's fairly common, you know, for research analyst prices to sort of lag, right?
Yeah.
It's understood in this sector that something will, you know, the research analyst forecast lags on the positive and the negative on both sides in terms of the price forecast. Today, you definitely see that in the cobalt price. So we're pretty excited to start seeing, number one, hopefully some upgrades, but we shall see as people revise their price decks for what was an outcome that does not appear to have been included or reflected in broker price forecasts on the cobalt side, and potentially have much stronger revenue growth in the short term as a result of higher prices.
Got it. And just to be clear, that is producing right now. So you're getting paid right now, correct? And then more is coming online. Again, I'm just saying this for clarity. More is coming online. More production is coming online in 26, correct?
That's absolutely correct. Yeah. So it's, you know.
I laugh because it's music to my ears as a shareholder, guys, and I shouldn't. So anyways, go ahead.
Look, it's been bumpy for us since we owned this asset. We bought it. Cobalt prices were $23, $24. They went up to $40 per pound. Then they went to $14, and now they're kind of on the way back up. So it's been a bit of volatility, but it's obviously a lot more fun on the way up. And actually today it's much more meaningful because the transition to the underground was slower than expected. So we just haven't seen the volumes that we've expected. And we're delighted to be at a point where you see the price tailwinds coinciding with really strong volume growth from the operation. To get both at the same time is fantastic.
Fantastic. So let's talk about rare earths here. And just to all my viewers and listeners, there's a little bit of confusion with rare earths. When I mean confusion, I don't even know what to call them because I call them minerals at sometimes. I call them metals at sometimes. And I call them elements, or I have called them elements in the past, but I was on the off camera. I was talking to Marco. What do you call this? And he correctly called them elements. So not so much what's the difference, but what is really the exposure? And as an investor of Ecora and the excitement you have around rare earths as an investor, that was another thing, just another thing that I found very attractive about the company and the stock. So talk to me about rare earths. Where do you see that going? The supply demand issue. And if you see that continuing here over the next several years.
Yeah, so your first part of your question, what do we mean by rare earths? Well, specifically what we're talking about are 15 elements, right? And if you sort of dust off your chemistry periodic table.
I failed chemistry. No, go ahead, go ahead.
Right. That's that you can go specifically see there, and this is all over the internet for anyone who just Googles it. You can specifically see which elements are included.
Yeah.
Now, the reason in part that rare earths are such are so topical that while they are absolutely sort of distributed throughout the planet, the challenge is finding them in economic concentrations. Mm-hmm. Right. So these minerals, absolutely, the elements are distributed throughout the Earth's crust. And I can't stress that enough. The key is finding them in concentrations in one place, in one deposit that permit extraction and profitable sale, right? That's the key. The rare earth market this year, and so many commentators say that the rare earth market has structurally changed and I'm inclined to agree, actually.
I would agree as well, but go ahead.
All right, so what have we seen this year? Well, first of all, earlier this year in April, and is from a strategic perspective, I mean, right? When you if you're a government and you're looking at the rare earth markets, let's the market fundamentally changed, I think, when the Chinese government, as a result of ongoing trade discussions, used the rare earths they produce as a geopolitical tool. So China is a dominant market share in rare earths. I think that most people understand that, but I'm not sure if people understand just how dominant. China produced over 90% of the world's supply of output in 2023, which is sort of the latest sources of estimates that are available, and that hasn't materially changed. And 63% of all feedstock comes from China, Myanmar, or other regions in other close by regions. So a very tight strangle on just the mining and extraction, and also on end products. And we saw the impact, right? When global auto manufacturers almost had to stop producing cars. And it wasn't just EVs, it was people couldn't get the right permanent magnets to put in a seatbelt for safety reasons and a combustion engine. And that's an issue. And part of the issue for many is that the quantities of rare earths, particularly the magnets, for example, and focusing on the magnets that are used as a piece of value from the wider product is tiny. So in other words, the cost of rare earth magnets in an EV or a combustion engine is a fraction of the value of the car. But very difficult to substitute some of these magnets out without reducing performance or cost. So our exposure at Ecora is primarily to four of the elements of the 15 that are generally considered as rare earth elements. This is neodymium, praseodymium, terbium, and we. Oh, I forgot. Did I say three? Dysprosium. So
Yes.
neodymium, praseodymium, and terbium, and dysprosium. Right. So neodymium and Nd and Pr, right, are called light rare earths, and then the heavies are terbium and dysprosium. And generally, why do we call them light or heavy? It's because of their atomic weight. So in other words, and again, for any of the chemists out there, this will be obvious, but if anyone's not across this, it's worth mentioning. These elements have very similar atomic weights, which makes them, for lack of a better word, bond, have a strong sort of chemical bonds, and separating them is quite challenging. And so you split the heavies into, you split, generally refer to rare earths as heavy or light. And the challenge for producers, I've heard it once described as separating rare earths is a bit like trying to take fruit juice and then separate the fruit juice back into apple juice, banana juice, pear juice, watermelon juice, whatever. So that's really in part why China has been able to position itself with just such strong market share, is that they've invested quite a lot to develop the supply chain and to benefit from having that ecosystem. Now, this is changing. We spoke about how the April event triggered a response from Western governments. And the big one that everyone has read about is the US government's investment into MP Materials, which entailed a $400 million equity investment. I think it was $150 million loan financing agreement to expand supply or production. And also a offtake for around 10 years at a price that was well above market. So what you have happening now, to sort of take it back to what I said earlier about how the market has changed, is you have state involvement to build out these supply chains. And number two, you have pricing, which is bifurcating from the Chinese levels, from what has been historically the sort of price benchmark. It's called Asian metals. You can see it online. The floor price set with the US government and MP Materials seems to be emerging as a bit of a reference point for other Western producers to use as a price benchmark. Previously, that was not the case. And I think the other thing that you're seeing is just real tight markets in Europe in particular. It's been reported that the price of dysprosium and terbium are three times the reported prices from China. And that's just a function of availability and spot tightness. So we're obviously very, very pleased with how this market is developing. We're really pleased to see the world taking action in the West anyways to secure these supply chains. And we feel like we're very well positioned by virtue of a royalty we have over a project called Palabora, owned by Rainbow Rare Earths. And this project is amongst, in our view, the highest quality development projects in the world, if not the highest outside of China, in part because it's not a mine. So what you have here is the grade of a hard rock deposits, and rare earth grades, I mean, but without the operating costs because the material is contained in phosphogypsum tailings. So in other words, material that's a waste stream,
right,
in phosphate fertilizer. So this is a project that's expected to announce a definitive feasibility study later this year. And then from there, the next step could be financing and first production. So the project really does seem to be aligning its source of supply with a strong market need for new sources of supply, independent of providing independent sources of supply to the West.
Got it. Can you give any specific guidance when that you'll start collecting revenue from that project?
Yeah, the company is targeting first production in 27, 28. So, you know, we ran the math. If you were to assume the price that was set in between the offtake by the Department of Defense and MP Materials for NdPr, that's $110 per kilogram. And you assume sort of market prices for dysprosium and terbium, that implies to us around $3 million a year of income. That is pretty attractive considering we bought the royalty for 8.5.
Yeah. So to all my viewers and listeners here, this is one of the not all royalties companies are the same, many good ones out there, all of that. But another thing that I look at, and there's many things I look at in evaluating, you want to see the structure when stuff is hitting, if you would. You have copper hitting that has hit and hitting now, even more so. You have cobalt, correct me if I'm wrong, Mark, that will be hitting here. All right. On cobalt, I don't remember. I was taking notes here. Is that in production now or that will be in production?
No, the Voisey's Bay mine has been producing for over 20 years.
Okay, so you're already in production with that royalty. So you're getting money for that. But then rare earths, that will be coming on in production here in the next 2 to 3 years, correct?
Yeah, that's a company's target.
Yep.
I think because that project in many ways is, because it's not a mine, the project's economics are really attractive, right? There's mm-hmm. no stripping.
Right.
There's no waste overburden movement. There's no crushing.
Fast tracked.
Yeah. So the operating costs, but also the capital costs required that are estimated today, anyways, estimated to be required to bring the project into production, compare really favorably to what would be a more traditional hard rock rare earth deposit.
Right.
So while at this stage it's difficult, the project still has some more hurdles to proceed before we see first income. There are a number of features about this project that we find really, really attractive and suggest that the project is more likely to come into production sooner rather than later.
Yeah. But my point being to all my viewers and listeners, you have production now, you have production growth in the intermediate term, if you would. And then I hate to say it long term because I call it intermediate, but in the next 3 years, you even have more production from a different asset class. Coming online. So you just have things that are hitting. And so, and that doesn't happen overnight. That takes a lot of strategy, a lot of timing and all of that, but that's where Ecora is right now. Which leads me to just value here of the share price, value of Ecora. I was lucky enough to buy soon after I met with you, if you would. And you've had, even in the past, really 6 weeks since I bought you, you guys have had a really good run here. Why should people still find value really in Ecora? And why would I even say, and I think, and these are my words, I don't want to put words in your mouth, why I think really your best years are ahead of you As opposed to, hey, we've got to run up on the stock. I'm going to lock in profits and take my money and go find something else. But what would you say to that?
So we spent a lot of time speaking today about, of course, critical minerals exposures, right? But that really has not always been the case. Historically, Ecora's revenue was primarily sourced from a steelmaking coal royalty. And what we find ourselves at today
Met
is
coal, right?
met coal. We're at this inflection. We seem to be approaching or at, or we have passed, around, in any event, close to this inflection point where Ecora is no longer seen for what it was, which is primarily a sort of runoff met coal royalty, which is out decidedly out of fashion, and to what it is, right? Increasingly viewed for what it is, which is a really fast-growing critical minerals royalty business, which has, from its producing assets at research analyst forecasts, the ability to generate $50 million a year. Just from the assets that we have today over mines that are already in production by the end of this decade, and then potential for another 50 million to 110, depending on the exact timing and when of some of the projects over which we have royalties coming into production. So that sort of, perception change, I think, has really accelerated following the release of our H1 results this year, when we saw an 81% growth from our base metals royalty, for example. And that growth in the base metals assets is expected to continue and into next year and beyond. So that, I think, partially, in my opinion anyways, explains some of the share price momentum since July, right? It's just a question of seeing Ecora either as a sort of uninteresting met coal royalty company with a runoff royalty or a fast-growing critical minerals royalty company. And in that sense, we're still at trading today at levels that are not too far away from the estimated value of the producing royalties. So at this entry point, there's really a strong opportunity for anyone who believes in the growth of the company to get exposure to this royalty portfolio at a very defensive entry point, and one that provides substantial price upside simply by virtue of some of the royalties that we have that are not yet in production, not appearing to be reflected in the share price.
Yeah. I'm going to put on my trader hat, if you would, or you can call it a longer term investor hat as well. And if you look at a stock price, picking bottoms is darn near impossible, if you would, as well as picking tops. And if you just look at, to all my viewers and listeners, if you just look at, again, any stock or any chart, commodity chart or whatever, what you really want to see is like, okay, where's the upturn? And then you want to take as much out of the middle as you can, if you would, if you're looking at upside. And so again, this is my thoughts only, not Mark's. This is not advice. But I see Ecora, you just look at a chart, you see that bump coming up, and then I'm looking now at really where. How long is this going to run? And then I just take this information and talking with Mark, and it sounds to me, again, do your own due diligence, that this has years to run, if you would, just because all of these producing assets, not only what you have right now, show I think much higher valuation than what the Ecora has right now. But then just take into account all the stuff that's going to be hitting that we just talked about and continue to hit over the next several years. Mark, if people want to invest in you, get more information about Ecora, how do they do that? Give us your website, give us your the platforms, the exchanges that you're chain traded on, and give us your ticker symbols.
Yeah, so we are on two exchanges and a third platform for your American viewers who are keen to trade on a US platform. You can do so on the OTCQX. Our ticker there is ECRAF. We also have a listing on the TSX. The ticker there is ECOR. And similarly on the London Stock Exchange, the ticker ECOR.
Got it. Any final thoughts you want to give to all of our viewers and listeners until I see you next time?
I think the short version is, Andy, when we last spoke, we spent a lot of time discussing the volume growth in this portfolio, right? From the producing assets, the potential for brownfield expansions, for new assets potentially coming online. And the big difference today is, I think, the short-term price momentum we have and the tailwinds, in particular in copper, cobalt, uranium, and we have a small producing gold royalty. But many of our key income-generating commodities are seeing really strong pricing tailwinds. We of course, are excited to see how this plays out in the fourth quarter, and also next year. When you combine volume growth expectations with the possibility of strong price potential, that sort of compounding effect is a wonderful, wonderful place to be.
Yeah, excellent. Mark Bishop, always a Mark Bishop LaFleche. Always a pleasure to talk to you. It really is. And I look forward to the next time really soon.
Thanks, Andy.
All right, have a great day.